Welcome inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly. This week, we'll hear the next part of Colt Brogan's Struggle to Stay.
It's the last time we talked, a lot's happened. A little bit after we talked, I just felt like in complete turmoil.
And we'll travel to a storytelling conference in Tennessee to hear a tall tale told by nationally known storyteller Susie Waples.
Grammy, you wear thongs at the beach? And I'm like, well, yes, everybody does. I mean, I know that when you first start wearing them, they can rub a blister. But...
And we'll hear another story about some friendly childhood competition by Bill Lepp, also an award-winning storyteller and author.
And I said, so remember, because I like to say useful things to my children, remember, if nobody wins, everybody's a loser.
You'll find these stories and more this week, Inside Appalachia. Welcome Inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly. Have you ever considered leaving home? Or wondered what your life would be like if you left Appalachia? Or maybe you, like many Appalachians, have left. Perhaps you returned. We've heard a number of your stories on social media these last few weeks, and we hope to hear from more of you. Tell us about your struggle to stay in Appalachia. You can send us a tweet at InAppalachia or send us an email to feedback@wvpublic.org. Justin Doak wrote and said he was born and raised in West Virginia, moved away, but he returned. Now he says he's struggling to make a living here in the state. We also heard from Nevin Banham, who says he can't find funds to support his business plan. Are you struggling to stay in Appalachia? Have you found a way to stay? Send us your story, and we may read it on the air. Again, our email is feedback@wvpublic.org. We'll kick things off this week by hearing the next part of Colt Brogan's story. It's part of our new series called The Struggle to Stay. Our reporters have spent the past 6 months following several Appalachians who are trying to figure out how to survive in Appalachia if they stay, or just to pick up and leave. Last week on The Struggle to Stay, we heard from 20-year-old Colt Brogan. He told us what he wants is a home, some land to grow a garden, and to have a family, kind of like his boss, Ben. Colt's motivated because his own childhood was troubled.
I come to houses like Ben's house, and I see a family doing well. I mean, they have a house, they get along, it seems, and their kids are happy. And I get tore up inside, and I can't fight back tears, and I'm just feel out of place.
But he's determined to make a home for himself and maybe eventually have a family farm where teenagers are welcome to work and stay. But for now, that's a far-off dream. For the past year and a half, he's been working for a farming training program called Refresh Appalachia. In addition to working in a small greenhouse, he also gets paid for the time he spends going to college. Colt says this job at Refresh Appalachia and learning to farm means a lot to him. If he can succeed becoming a farmer, he hopes it will help him to build a life for himself here in West Virginia. But the program is demanding, and he doesn't have a lot of time off. Since we last heard from Colt, things haven't been easy. He shared the latest updates with Roxy Todd.
It's September 2nd, and since the last time we talked, a lot's happened. A little bit after we talked, I just felt like in complete turmoil. Got to the point where I couldn't really wash my clothes really well. Sometimes I do it by hand.
Washing his clothes became a problem because Colt's washing machine broke. That same week, his car broke down.
I carpool, and they encourage us to carpool and stuff at the company, but...
Carpooling worked until one day when his coworker was off sick. Colt's boss said he had to find another solution, so he started walking about a mile to work and school on days when he couldn't get a ride. On top of his job, Colt stresses about managing all the work for his college classes. Some of his coworkers have left because the time commitments were too strict. One coworker was fired for not showing up to their classes. But Colt isn't a quitter. He's tough, and he's proud of that.
If you want to stay here in West Virginia, then I believe you're doing something right. Because it's hard to want to stay here, in my opinion. It is so rough.
Then, things suddenly spun out of control.
My cousin called me, and I answered the phone. It's like 7 in the morning, and she told me that my mom's house burned down. She's like, it's gone. It's It burned down, it's gone. Didn't really say much else.
Colt called his boss and said he needed the day off. Since his car was still broken down, a coworker drove him to what was left of his mom's house.
And it was gone. I mean, the top story was just burnt. And there were two walls, like, standing, but, like, I think it's just because it started in the middle and, like, burned, you know, towards the outside, and it just took a while. But, I mean, there's just nothing salvageable. Everything in the basement, if it didn't get burnt, it got soaked and, like, nasty.
This was the house along the Coal River where Colt spent a lot of his childhood. His 7-year-old half-brother, River, had been staying at his Aunt Beth's, so he was okay. Colt's mom escaped with no serious injuries, which was surprising because the blaze started right by her bed while she was asleep from a candle she'd left burning. She did have a big burn mark on her forehead. The fire department took a while to respond to the 911 call because Colt's mom lives in Alum Creek, right on the county line, so the dispatchers couldn't agree on which county was responsible for her home. This is the call between emergency dispatchers at Kanawha County and Lincoln County 911.
5379.
Yeah, we have 5025. You have a report of a structure fire.
According to Colt's Aunt Beth, this conversation between the two counties was going on after the house had already burned. She says they'd actually made two earlier calls to 911 asking for help.
Okay, on the riverside or... Because we have the roadway, but the river and everything on that side is in y'all's county. Is it on the...
I'm trying to find out, ma'am. I've got 3 EMS calls I have to dispatch. I'm so sorry.
Okay, let me figure this out. All right.
According to Colt's aunt, two local volunteer firefighters heard this conversation on the dispatch radio, and they brought in the fire departments from surrounding areas. But by the time the firefighters arrived, the house was a total loss. There wasn't much they could do. Everything was ruined, including dozens of musical instruments, their family's quilts, baby photos. By the way, this was not their first fire. When Colt was 2 years old, their first house along the Coal River burned down. And being so close to the river, Colt and his mother, Maria Murado, have also been flooded several times.
After the waters went down, it's nothing but sludge and nasty, stink, gross. They would, you know, we would have to get tetanus shots and bleach and go at it like that.
So they've lost things in the past, but this recent fire was the worst. In the middle of the chaos after the house burned, Colt's mom took off and didn't tell anybody. Colt was angry that his mom left without saying goodbye.
We didn't do nothing. We didn't do nothing accomplished today other than the house burned down. And it's just like the whole day was wasted. And that was the only day I had to give, too. So it was like hurt. Like it just hurt because it's like it's impossible for me to take off work. Like it's so hard.
I asked Colt if it hurt to see his childhood home burn. He said he doesn't look at it that way, that he's already said goodbye to this house. When he was 17 and left home, he says he wanted it to be a clean break.
When I moved from there, I took my boots and stuff, 2 changes of clothes, and I was out, and I didn't care if I'd never got to go back. I mean, that's how I felt when I moved out of there. You know, I got enough to survive, no matter what it, you know, whatever it takes, like, I'm okay. I don't feel like that now. I mean, I don't feel like what I did was a mistake, but I don't feel like that you can ever, like, really sever those ties once they're there. I mean, that's why they call them ties, right? You can't, I mean, you say you do, you say you'd never talk to these people, you say a lot, but if you really loved somebody, even at one point in your time, it's like there's always somewhat of a connection.
One of the only things that made it out of the fire was a ceramic box Colt had given his mom years ago when he was about 4 or 5 years old.
It was like a jewelry box. It was shaped like a heart. It said mom on the top. And I thought that was just like kind of amazing.
His Aunt Beth says she's still hoping that Colt and his mom can eventually work things out.
Oh, it's my prayer every night that things eventually work out. But I don't know. I really don't. Two stubborn people don't always work together.
There is some happy news to share. Well, actually two things. But I'm going to wait until next week to tell you. For Inside Appalachia, I'm Roxy Todd in Lincoln County, West Virginia.
We'll hear the conclusion to Colt's Struggle to Stay story next week here on Inside Appalachia. But the Struggle to Stay series continues. Over the next few months, we'll meet five Appalachians as they struggle with the question, do I stay or do I go? We're going to take a short break. When we come back, we'll travel to the Storytelling Festival in Jonesboro, Tennessee, to hear award-winning storyteller Susie Waples. That's coming up at the next part of our show. You're Inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly.
Support for Inside Appalachia is provided by Concord University in Athens, West Virginia. With career-focused liberal arts education in more than 80 degrees and programs to pursue various career options, not just a single job. More at concord.edu.
We tend to think our listeners are the best listeners. We have thousands of them across the country, and our show airs on 11 stations across Central Appalachia. Thank you for listening to Inside Appalachia, and thank you for supporting this local station. Your support helps keep stories like these on the air. Here in Appalachia, we have a rich cultural tradition of storytelling. For the next part of our show, we're featuring storytellers from the West Virginia Storytellers Guild. Next, we'll hear a story about a thong. No, really, it's about a thong. Susie Waples hails from Dunbar, West Virginia. She told this next story at the National Storytelling Festival in Jonesboro, Tennessee.
Oh, thank you. You know, I believe kind of what goes around comes around, or there's really nothing new under the sun. They just bring it back with a new name. Like the other day, I was down shopping, and I saw a hula hoop. Only it was called an exercise ring. And I was buying some new pants, and the girl said, do you like these capris? I said, honey, when I was in school, they were called pedal pushers. And the kids are just crazy about flip-flops. You know, they wear them everywhere. When I was in school, they were called Zoris or thongs. Y'all remember that? You remember? Well, I had promised last year to take my two oldest granddaughters to the beach, and they are just a joy. And one of them was 17, that's Emily, my oldest granddaughter, and the other one's 14, Stephanie. And so we're at the house, and I'm making this list of everything I got to get to take to the beach, and I you know, like beach towels and sunglasses and sunblock, and you know, isn't that funny that we go to the beach to block the sun? Anyway, and so I'm writing this list, and I say, Emmy, honey, you got any thongs to wear to the beach? And she just kind of sits there for about half a minute, and then she goes, no. And I said, well, I have to get you some. And I said, honey, I said, Stephanie, honey, you got any? And she's like, no. And I said, thongs are wonderful. They're perfect for the beach. I mean, I wouldn't go without mine. And Stephanie says, like, Grammy, you wear thongs at the beach? And I'm like, well, yes, everybody does. I mean, I know that when you first start wearing them, they can rub a blister. But to get used to them. You don't, can't even tell you got nothing on. And if you get sand in them, honey, all you got to do is walk down the edge of the water, take them off, rinse them out, and put them back on. They're perfect. Well, my girls both turned a funny color. And they excused themselves and went upstairs. And they were up there for about 15 minutes. And Emily come back down, Stephanie following her. And Emily said, Grammy, you know that I love you with all my heart, don't you? I said, of course, and I love you the same. And she said, and you know I would never, ever hurt your feelings for nothing. And I said, oh, I know that, baby. And she said, but Grammy, could for this summer while Stephanie and I are with you, could you just not wear your thongs at the beach? And I said, well, for goodness sakes, you girls are so silly, but if it means that much to you, I will not wear my thongs at the beach this year. And they looked at each other and kind of went, oh. And they started back up the stairs. But before they got out of earshot, I said, I'll tell you what, I won't wear mine, but you'll never convince your papa not to wear his. I love you. I love you. anyway, and I got, I'm so blessed. I had three wonderful boys, like Connie said, two preachers and a fireman. And they were the joy of my heart, unless they were killing me. They were wonderful. And out of those three boys came 10 grandbabies. And my middle boy, Freddie, who's a pastor in Concord, North Carolina, and he adopted 5 children, and his baby is named Lydia, and she's of Hispanic ancestry, and she's got big old black flashing eyes and black, coal black, beautiful hair, and she's got a little dark skin. She's just beautiful, and so one time I was at their house visiting, and I had a wonderful visit with the youngins, and she was sitting on the bed, and I was packing, getting ready to go home, and she was playing with her baby doll, and my hair clips. You know, those things you squeeze, and she was clipping up her baby's hair, and I wasn't paying attention to her. I was just putting my stuff in the suitcase and stuff, and she said, Grammy, Grammy, look, and I turned around, she's holding her little finger up, and I thought, she pinched her finger with one of those clips. I knew that was going to happen. And I said, oh, baby, Grammy's baby got a boo-boo. Grammy, just kiss it, make it better. I was like, mwah. And turned around, started doing what I was doing. Well, after a few minutes, I looked back at her, and she's still sitting there like this. Only now, big old tears are running down her cheeks. I said, Lydia, baby, what's wrong, honey? She said, Grammy, what'd you do with my booger?
That was award-winning storyteller Susie Waples, who lives in Kanawha County. Today, we're sharing stories from famous Appalachian storytellers. This next story is about first loves and flaming bicycles. It's told by a man from Charleston, West Virginia, who was called a side-splitting funny man by the Smithsonian Center for Folklife. Here's Firebike by Bill Lepp.
We were sitting at the top of Weatherwood Hill. Weatherwood Hill is the hill that I grew up on in some of my stories. And Weatherwood Hill is about a mile from the top of Weatherwood Hill to the bottom of Weatherwood Hill. And for the first third of the mile, it was almost straight up and down. And then it sort of flattened out as it went by Claridge Circle. And for the last third of the mile, it was even more almost straight up and down than the first third of the mile. And at the bottom of the hill, there was a curve. And when I was a child, we would have called it something like Dead Man's Curve. But now we know that children are much too sensitive for that sort of language. So now we would call it something like Wicked Timeout Curve. And if you missed the curve, you went off the road, and there were about 12 trees, and then there was a cliff, about a 14,000-foot cliff. I went to look at it the other day, and something's happened, because now it's only about 3 feet, but it was 14. When I was a kid, 14,000 feet. And at the bottom of that cliff, there was a pool of inky black liquid that our parents told us never to touch. They said if we touched that liquid, it would eat the flesh off of our bodies. Because you have to understand that Charleston, West Virginia, for about 40 miles going down the Kanawha River, in the 70s and 80s, there was nothing but chemical plants. And all of those chemical companies back then were environmentally conscious. And by that, I mean they were conscious that the environment was there. And that was a great place to dump waste. And all of that waste went down and collected in the pool at the bottom of that cliff. And our parents told us if we ever touched it, it would eat the flesh off of our bodies. And they told us never to go swimming in it, because if we went swimming in it, we would awake the mer creatures that lived at the bottom. And they would rise to the surface, mermaids and mermen, and they would eat the flesh off of our bodies. And we thought, well, that doesn't make any sense, because you told us the liquid would eat the flesh off of our bodies. So by the time the mer creatures get up there, there'd be nothing left to eat. Those poor mer creatures, they must be starving to death. But we left it at that. So there we were, on top of Weberwood Hill. We were sitting on our bicycles. We were getting ready to ride our bicycles down Weberwood Hill. And the goal was to ride all the way down the hill, never touch your brakes, be in 10th gear by the time you got to my house, which was the fourth house down the hill, and pedal the entire way down the hill. And the reason we wanted to do this is because we thought if we pedaled hard enough, we could build up enough friction on our sprockets that we could set our chains on fire. And the reason we thought we could set our chains on fire is because Nora said we could. Nora was a girl in our neighborhood. She was the smartest girl in the neighborhood. She was the funniest girl in the neighborhood. She was the most talented girl in the neighborhood. She was the most beautiful girl in the neighborhood. She might have been the most beautiful, talented, funniest, smartest girl in the whole world. But I don't know. We hadn't been to the whole world. So I can't say, and I don't like to generalize. I don't mind exaggerating, but I don't like to generalize. And we were right at that age where boys start to think to themselves, well, if girls have cooties, maybe cooties aren't such a bad thing to have. So when Nora said things like, if you paddle hard enough, you can set your chains on fire, all the boys in the neighborhood said, uh-huh, Nora, you're pretty. We'll do it. And that is not something that boys ever outgrow. Now, to be completely honest with you, I didn't want to set my chain on fire. I just wanted to know the kid who set his chain on fire. Because when I was growing up, whenever I was about to do something stupid, my dad would rush into the room. So you're probably thinking, well, when did he have time to get anything else done? That's not nice. Whenever I was about to do anything stupid, my dad would rush into the room. He'd be like, no, 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 never cut glass with scissors. He'd say Dan Carlisle tried to cut glass with scissors. The glass broke. Dan cut his hand off. He was never the same afterwards. Or Dad would say, no, 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 never tie your sled to a moving car. Dan Carlisle tied his sled to a moving car. The car stopped. Dan didn't. He hit his head. He was never the same afterwards. Our dad would say, no, 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 never put a slug in your ear. Dan Carlisle put a slug in his ear, ate his brain. He was never the same afterwards. Now, I could never follow the chronology of poor Dan's life, but I know for a fact that he was never the same afterwards. So I didn't want to set my chain on fire. I just wanted to know the kid who set his chain on fire. And my chief candidate was a kid named Elmore Lofink. Now, Elmore, you have to understand about Elmore. Elmore played T-ball for 2 years. Now, just in case you're not familiar with T-ball, it's a lot like baseball, except there's nobody pitching the ball. There's a stand on home plate that is about as half as tall as this microphone, and they take a baseball, set that right on top of the stand. There's a little rubber piece on top of the stand. The baseball goes right on top of that stand, and then the batter comes up, stands there, swings, and hits the ball. The ball is not moving. It's not coming at you at 90 miles an hour. It's not sinking. It's not sliding. It's not corkscrewing. It's just sitting there. 2 years.
Elmore played T-ball. Never got a hit. He bruised and battered the air above the ball. He sent the little rubber thing under the ball over the second baseman's head on several occasions, but the ball just went thunk. 2 years, he got held back. He had to play remedial T-ball. And in our culture, that's more embarrassing than getting held back in school. Now, when I took my kids to play T-ball, you know, the coaches were very specific. They said, okay, when we play, there's no outs. Everybody on the team gets to bat every inning, and we don't keep score. First of all, the kids aren't keeping score. Second of all, I told my kids, well, when I played T-ball, there were three outs. You got three outs every inning, and not everyone got to bat. And if you got a hit, you went to first base. And then you went to second base if you advanced, third base. And if you got to go all the way around the bases and came back and touched home plate, we called that a run, and somebody made a mark in a book. And at the end of the game, one team would have more runs than the other team, and we would call the team with more runs the winner. And I said, so remember, because I like to say useful things to my children, remember, if nobody wins, everybody's a loser. You shouldn't encourage that. So Elmore graduated from the baseball arts to the bicycling arts. And of all the people that wanted to set their chain on fire, Elmore most wanted to set his chain on fire, and I was perfectly willing to allow him to do it. And the reason Elmore most wanted to set his chain on fire is because of all the boys in the neighborhood who had a crush on Nora, Elmore had the biggest crush. Elmore wanted to date Nora. He wanted to stand beneath her window with a fiddle and serenade Nora. He wanted to write her love poems. Nora, Nora, how I adore you. And then he wanted to be engaged to Nora. He wanted to marry Nora. He wanted to have 1,000 children with Nora and spend the rest of his life with Nora. And Nora did not feel the same way about Elmore. Nora thought that if she had to spend the rest of her life with Elmore, maybe they could be neighbors if there were a couple of houses in between. But Elmore was certain that if he could set his chain on fire, he could win Nora's heart. So Nora said, go, and we started off down the hill. Now, we were not wearing safety gear. I was the last generation that could go out and play properly. When my mother said, go play, she meant, go put yourself in harm's way. When I was a kid, you know, shortly after breakfast, your adult would say to you, go away. And you were not expected home until the lights came on for supper. And if you said to your mother before you left, okay, mother, I'll go, but can I have a box of matches and a stick of dynamite? Your mother would say, well, be careful with it. We were what Andy Offutt Irwin calls the bicycle generation, which means we could go anywhere in the world on our bicycle so long as we were home for supper. If you wanted to go to Chicago and shoot pool in a smoky blues hall, nobody cared as long as you were home for supper. And people didn't wear safety gear. Only 4 kinds of people wore safety gear when I was a kid: professional football players, construction workers, firemen, and astronauts. If your job did not include purposely running into another human being, having an I-beam dropped on your head, running into a burning building, or re-entering the atmosphere, if you wore safety gear, you were sort of a wimp, and that's all there was to it. I mean, think, not even hockey players wore helmets back then. This was a wide open time. And then when my daughter was little, I was putting her on that seat on the back of my bicycle, so I put her helmet on and her little glove so she wouldn't rake the flesh off of her palm should she go sliding across the asphalt, and her elbow pads and her knee pads and her shin guards and her Kevlar vest. Until all you could even see that she was a human, she just had this moon face sticking out. And I put her on the seat and I strapped her in and I went to get on the bicycle and I swung my leg and bam! I kicked her right in the face. Now, only place I could have hurt her. Not, let's be clear, not on purpose, you understand that. that didn't even really happen to me. I read that in Reader's Digest. But I liked it, so I stole it, and that is how you cite a source. Plus, we didn't need safety gear because we had something the children don't have today. We had something called tough skin blue jeans. Tough skin blue jeans were made by the Sears Roebuck Corporation. They were made from DuPont Tri-Bond 490 polyester. They had reinforced knees. The sales slogan was, "Your children will outgrow them before they wear them out." I am the last of five children. I did not own a piece of clothing that was new until I was 28. And so, when I got tough skin jeans, they were hand-me-downs, and still you could not bend your knees with those reinforced. Everybody walked around the neighborhood like they had just peed their pants. And the thing about tough skins was they came in myriad colors, but the dominant color was a deep, dark shade of blue that we called peed your pants blue. So you never knew which kid had and which kid hadn't. But those things were bulletproof. You could be going down the highway at 80 miles an hour in the back of a pickup truck and your dad hits a bump, one kid goes flying out, hits the asphalt. That child would be fine if they were wearing tough skin blue jeans. And they just kept from their hip to their ankle on the asphalt. They just slide across the asphalt until they ran out of steam. The only thing that could possibly go wrong is if you had one of these little metal rivets and sparks started to come off of it. If you were beside a tanker truck and the tanker truck was leaking, it might explode. But you would be fine. Well, no, you wouldn't. You would be gone from your waist up and your ankles down. But anything covered by the tough skin jeans would be fine. So Nora said, go. We're going down the hill, pedaling as hard as we could. You're probably asking yourself, how could you pedal a bicycle if you had reinforced knees that you couldn't bend? Don't overthink the story. We got to my house. I was already in 10th gear. I was trying to remember, front brake, back brake, front brake, back brake. Because if you're going down a hill that's almost straight up and down at 712 miles an hour and you hit your front brake, what's going to happen? You're going to cartwheel. You're going to look just like Colonel Steve Austin at the beginning of The $6 Million Man when he's coming in for that horrible landing. Already kids were chickening out. You could hear kids like, oh, I believe I hear my mother calling me for the noon repast. I must return home. So kids were just falling off by the wayside. And I was looking for dogs. Now, I'll tell you why I was looking for dogs. Because my father said to me, you have to be very careful on those bicycles because those tires are razor thin. And if you are going fast enough and you hit a dog. Now, this is one of those things that adults say to children that seem like a good idea when they leave the adult's mouth. Like, we're just standing there. You've seen adults standing around. We got our back against the wall and we're just kind of like, And then an idea will blossom in our head like a tulip. A little idea will bloom in our minds and it'll be like, I'm a good idea. I'm a smart idea. Find a young person, share me with a young person. So we go and we find a young person. We're like, young person. And the idea starts down through our head and it's like, smart, smart, smart. And it comes into our mouth, smart, smart. And it comes out of our mouth, smart, smart. And about halfway between our mouth and the young person's ear, that idea goes dumb, dumb, dumb. So my dad said to me, watch out for dogs, because those tires are razor thin, and if you hit a dog, and I know he meant be careful, don't hit a dog. He said, if you hit a dog, you will cut the dog in half. And then all I could think was, I want to hit a dog. And it's now that I don't like dogs, I love dogs, but maybe it could be a rabid dog, sort of an Atticus Fitch thing, you know? Go read a book. And Dad meant if you hit a dog in the side, I wanted to hit a dog in the nose and see if I could just split it right down the middle. So I'm going down the hill. Elmore was right beside me. Nora was a little bit behind us. Nora couldn't set her chain on fire because Nora didn't have a bicycle. Because when Nora was born, we never knew why, but her legs had never worked. So she had been in a wheelchair her whole life. But she was the kind of kid that when she said to her parents, I am going to ride my wheelchair down the hill, they did not say,
Gosh, Nora, I think that would be a poor idea. Because they'd known her whole life, and they knew that she was gonna do it anyway. So when she said stuff like that, they said stuff like, oh Lordy, we better go take a welding class. And so they had welded her this wheelchair, this beautiful wheelchair. It was made out of steel pipes and steel beams, just welded together. It looked like the inside of a NASCAR race car. It had a plexiglass windshield, nets on the side, a steering wheel, big fat off-road tires, a seat with a 27-point harness system, and a handbrake. And because she couldn't set her chain on fire, she just had lengths of chain hanging out from behind her wheelchair that would slap into the ground great arcs of sparks just flying up behind her as she went down the hill. But because she had to rely on gravity, she was a little bit behind us. And we got down to Claridge Circle, where everything sort of flattened out, and now more kids were chickening out. Oh, I believe I'm having mechanical difficulties with my bicycle. I must pull to the side of the road. So by the time we got to that last part of the hill, that last third of the hill, the only people that were left were myself and Elmore and Nora just a little bit behind us. And as we started down that hill, I could smell hot metal. And I did not want to be on fire. I looked down to see if my sprocket was glowing or if my chain was on fire, but nothing. Everything was just as it should be, but I still smelled hot metal. It was like standing next to a radiator. So I looked over at Elmore's bicycle, and Elmore's sprocket was glowing bright red. It was almost molten. There were heat waves shimmering off of it, bouncing off his tough skin jeans, going up into the atmosphere, burning a hole in the ozone layer. And then all of a sudden, whoosh, 80 feet of flame shot out from behind his bicycle. It was like the afterburner on a jet fighter. And he was so excited, he was screaming, I'm on fire! I'm on fire! And he turned to Nora. He said, Nora, I'm on fire for you! And the symbolism was lost on us, but there it was. And I started to brake. Back brake, back brake, front brake, and Elmore started to brake. Back brake, back brake, front brake, and then shoo, Nora shot in between us, 712 miles an hour. Something had gone wrong on her wheelchair. Her brakes didn't work. She was going down the hill. She couldn't stop. There was no way she was going to make it around Wicked Timeout Curve. She was going to go off the road, through the trees, off the cliff, into the pit, and we didn't want that to happen because we liked Nora, but I didn't know what to do. And then Elmore did the bravest thing I've ever seen in my life. Elmore let go of the brakes on his bicycle. He started to pedal as hard as he could, and I had to find out what was going to happen, so I let go of the brakes on my bicycle, and I started to pedal as hard as I could. And just before Nora went off the road, when all that was separating her from certain doom was that thin white line on the edge of the road, Elmore did a move that spawned the X Games. He whipped in front of her on his bicycle, grabbed his front brake as hard as he could, stood his bicycle up on its front wheel, wiggled his hips, which caused his bike to spin in a great 360-degree arc. His back wheel hit the front of Nora's wheelchair and sent it rolling back up the hill. Here was a child who could not hit a baseball. Sitting stationary in front of him on a windless summer afternoon, who had just rotated his burning bicycle to knock a wheelchair back up the hill. And I jumped off my bicycle, I grabbed Nora's wheelchair, and I kind of ran it to a stop. Elmore jumped off his bicycle, and the three of us were just there over Elmore's bicycle. It was just laying there, like a head with its chicken cut off. And we watched it burn, breathing the asphalt fumes, which goes on to explain a few things. When it was all gone, and there was nothing left but some aluminum ash and some bubbles in the asphalt. When it was all gone, Nora looked up at Elmore, and she said to Elmore in that tone of voice that only girls can use. It's a tone of voice that girls can use that can make boys do anything. She looked up at Elmore with a twinkle in her eye, and she said to Elmore in that tone of voice, she said, Elmore, you can push me back up the hill.
That was award-winning storyteller and Appalachian funny guy, Bill Lepp, sharing this story called Fire Bike. Bill lives in Charleston, West Virginia, and is a five-time champion of the West Virginia Liars Contest. Well, from bicycles to roller skates, here's another tall tale about childhood and that feeling like you're on top of the world. Here's award-winning West Virginia storyteller Adam Booth telling Rollerama.
Now, I wasn't a particularly athletic child. I wasn't a big child, and I wasn't a very lucky child. So it took me until I was 11 years old before I won anything in my life. And this is that story. Now, when I was 11 years old, my home at 210 West 9th Avenue was in a row with all the other homes in our block. And if you went behind those homes, there was a railroad track just across the alley. And if you crossed the railroad track and went down a block and a half, there was Rollerama. That was our neighborhood roller skating rink. Now, I grew up in a poor family, and we didn't usually have the money to go over to Rollerama. But on Tuesday nights, you could get in for a discount, only $2. And every now and then, my family could manage to save up enough money to give me those $2 so that I could cross the railroad tracks, go down the block and a half, and there was Rollerama with a glass window on the very front with a semicircle cut out of it. And behind that window, a tall, bald man with a big nose and a mustache that would move when he talked. Give him the $2 for discount night, and he'd give you a ticket. You go in through the door that led to a hallway that was very long, and at the end of it, one hanging, flickering light bulb that seemed to move all on its own. At the very end of the hallway, two Texas-style swinging doors that we would slam our hands like this, bam, and they would fly open, and there was the lacing lobby at Rollerama, and kids were in a frenzy all over each other, trying to put their skates on. Now, over here, there was a counter on this side of the lacing lobby, and behind it, the same tall, bald man would appear, and you would go over and tell him your skate size, and he would go in the back and pick out skates for you out of a crate, and then come back to the counter and bend double, leaning all the way over to give you those skates. And the rental was part of the $2. Over on that side of the lacing lobby, there was another counter, and behind it, a very pretty young woman stood. And we were always attracted to that counter. Not because of the pretty young woman, we were still little children. We were attracted to it because of the smells that came from behind this counter. Pizza, corn dogs. And when you went over there, there was a little window built into the counter and you could see candy bars lined up behind it. And right on the corner of that white countertop, there was a tall, crystal clear barrel-shaped jar filled with kosher dill pickles. And I love kosher dill pickles. But as I mentioned, I came from a poor family and never had the money to get a pickle. I had the $2 to get in. I would get my rental skates and sit on one of those long wooden benches there in the lacing lobby. These were the pews of our roller skating church. I sat there and there was a bench built in underneath of it. Take my shoes off, put it under. And in the 80s, when I was a child, our roller skates were holdovers from the 70s and they came up all the way to your knees. And they were rental skates, and the laces were frayed at the end, so you'd have to lick your fingers and rub them around the ends, and then go up 30 pairs of eyelets all the way to your knee. And when you got to the top, there was still this much lace left over, so you wrapped it around your shin and did a big bunny ear. Then the other one all the way up, and it seemed to take forever, and all your friends were out on the roller skating rink, but finally, when you got them laced all the way up, you could step out of the lacing lobby onto the worn wooden boards of the roller skating rink with the first powerful push. And then we were going around and around, faster and faster. And out there you realize that the $2 didn't just pay for your admission or the skate rental. The $2, most importantly of all, bought freedom. Now, hanging from the ceiling of Rollerama, there was a great big board about a foot thick, this wide, that tall, and it was divided up into 9 different rectangles. and each rectangle had its own light bulb inside of it, and words painted on the outside. And normally this light bulb was lit up, and when it was lit up, the words shone and said, "All skate." We were flying around that rink. But sometimes that one went off, and this one over here turned on, and it said, "Couples only." And I was never on the rink for that one. Sometimes this one down here turned on. It was even worse. It said, "Ladies' Choice." And I was an unathletic, small, scrawny, geeky kid. And none of the ladies ever chose me. But sometimes this one would turn on, and it was my favorite. Because when this light bulb turned on, all the other lights would dim down to complete darkness. They would turn on a spotlight that shone a beam of light onto a disco ball right there in the center. And light would reflect off of it, dancing all around every wall of Rollerama. And the music would turn on. Bum, 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 ba-dum, ba-dum. Dun, 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 da-dun, da-dum. And the tall, bald man with the mustache would skate out to the center with a pair of poles that had pegs going up the side. Dun, 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 da-dum, ba-dum. Dun, 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 da-dun, da-dum. And the very pretty young woman from the concession stand would roller skate out. Dum, bum, bum, ba-dum, ba-dum. And crown those poles. Dun, da-dun, da-dum, ba-dum. With a wooden bar. And all the kids in Rollerama lined up behind it. At the very end of the line, after 20 or so kids, was me. Shorter than all the rest. And everyone lined up to play because if you were the winner, your prize was a coupon for one free concession. And I could look past that line of kids, past the poles with the pegs and the worn wooden boards, the lacing lobby right there to the corner of the concession counter where there was that crystal clear jar filled with my prize. And it started. Bum, 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 ba-dum, ba-dum, one by one. Dum, bum, bum, ba-dum, ba-dum, they went under. Dum, bum, bum, ba-dum, ba-dum, dun, dun, dum, ba-dum, ba-dum, dun, da-dum, ba-dum, ba-dum. And then it was my turn. Dun, dum, dum, da-dum, da-dum, dun, da-dum, da-dum, da-dum. And then there were 18 kids left. And they moved the bar down a few pegs. Dun, 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 da, dum, da, dum. Dun, da, dum, ba, dum, ba, dum. One by one. Dum, da, dum, ba, dum, ba, dum. Everyone took their turn. Dum, 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 da, dum, da, dum. Until it was my turn. Dun, da, dum, da, dum, da, dum. Dun, dum. Dun, da, dum, da, dum. Dun, da, dum, ba, dum, ba, dum. And then there were 9 kids left. Dun ta dum ta dum pa dum, dun ta dum pa dum ta dum, dun ta dum ta dum ta dum, dun 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 dun, dun 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 dun. Forward was harder. Dun da. But I could do it. Dun da dun da dum, dun ta dun da dun da dum. And then there were 2 kids left. And they moved the pole down so far that it looked like it was about 1/2 foot off of the ground. And I was first up. And at this point, it was time for the secret move, which if you grew up roller skating, you knew. You took your ear and put it over on your shoulder. And then you did a half split in the same direction, down as low as you could go, like that. You would reach your other hand out below your skate because they were 4 square wheels and there was room between the sole and where the wheels were. You could grab onto the bottom of your foot there, ear on your shoulder, half split, hand under your skate, grab on, take the deepest breath you could, and breathe out behind you for propulsion to get you going. And I was heading towards that bar. I saw the poles. There was a crowd out in the lacing lobby cheering me on. And as I got closer, I could see over top of the bar still. So I squatted down even lower. It was time for shallow prayers at this point, to things that were popular and small back then. Dwarves, smurfs, gnomes, things like that. Help get me under that pole. And as I got closer and closer, I was running out of steam. Right as I got there, and my head hit the bar and it fell off. Hitting the rink several times and rolling away. And I stood up and skated off of the rink and collapsed out in the lacing lobby and turned just in time to see Claire Pinson win. She was also really little, just like me. My eyes glued to my feet. The shame sank from the ceiling. I was that close to winning. And then I heard this voice from over my shoulder. Hey, nice move out there. I looked over my shoulder. It was Claire. I didn't want to talk to her. She had just beat me. Thanks. And I looked back down at the ground. And then her hand came over my shoulder and grabbed onto my hand and pulled me up and across the lacing lobby to where the concession counter was. She reached down into her pocket and pulled out that coupon she had just won and reached it way up and slid it across the counter. And that pretty woman came over, opened the glass jar, and pulled out one pickle. She gave it to Claire, and Claire used her little hands to snap it in half and shoved half into my hands, said, here. And Claire and I shared a cool, crisp, crunchy, kosher dill pickle. And then someone said, hey, look! And the all-skate light bulb turned off, and couples only turned on. And she said, come on, let's go. Grabbed me by the hand, pulled me out there. And around, and around, and around we flew. And that's the story of the first time I ever won anything in my life. Thanks.
That was storyteller Adam Booth. Adam grew up in Calhoun County and now lives in Shepherdstown, West Virginia. He's won numerous awards as a storyteller, educator, and musician. On our website, we've posted more information on upcoming live events and storytelling conferences here in West Virginia and in Tennessee. Until next week, thanks for joining me as we journey throughout Appalachia. Music in today's show was provided by Marisa Anderson, Dinosaur Burps, Bill Lepp and Becky Kimmons, Andy Agnew Jr., and Ben Townsend. Jesse Wright is our executive producer, who also edited our show this week. Roxy Todd helped produce. Our audio mixer is Patrick Stevens. We'd love to hear from you. You can email us at feedback@wvpublic.org. Find us on Twitter @InAppalachia or @JessicaYLilly. You can also address your letters to Inside Appalachia in care of West Virginia Public Broadcasting, 600 Capitol Street, Charleston, West Virginia, 25301. The Inside Appalachia podcast is available on iTunes, Downcast, and at wvpublic.org. I'm Jessica Lilly. Inside Appalachia is a news and public affairs production of West Virginia Public Broadcasting.